Hi, everybody. Today's Friday, September 5th, 2025, and our friends, Colonel Wilkerson and Larry Johnson, are back with us. Welcome back.
Hi there. It's shirt day. Colonel Wilkerson blowing it away again, as usual.
Shining, yeah.
I'm going to try to get a backdrop that looks like Waikiki, or better even, Waimea Bay.
Yeah.
Colonel, before starting the talk, you mentioned something that you said on Judge Knapp's shows. Right. Judge Knapp's show. What was that, the point that you are trying to make?
Yeah, I want to apologize to your listeners, to Judge's listeners and others, that I jumped to the conclusion that the one source I had checked, that the UN General Assembly had made a decision like it did in 1988 with regard to Yasser Arafat, to move to Geneva for the opening sessions and to allow the Palestinians to come on board, which is what we should do. But I subsequently learned that it was a false flag and it wasn't true. Could still happen, but I don't think so with this Secretary General, because basically he's a coward.
So let's start with, Colonel, with what has happened with Donald Trump in the aftermath of the SCO summit. Here is what he posted on the Social Truth just 3 hours ago. Looks like we've lost India and Russia to deepest, darkest China. May they have a long and prosperous future together. Donald Trump. How does he feel when you look at Donald Trump and his administration? How does he feel in your opinion right now?
Which one?
You, Colonel, I ask you.
Well, I mean, good on Donald Trump, because I can almost assure him that aside from our possible use of nuclear weapons, that they will have a warm and prosperous future.
Yeah.
Sad to say, I can't assure Donald Trump that the country he currently represents will have such a future.
I think if that's the case, if the way that he's trying to picture for us, he feels about Russia and China in the hands of or somehow closer to China. So what is he doing to avoid that? What is he doing to just improve the relationship between the United States and these countries, Larry?
Well, nothing. I mean, he's a petulant child. In your conversation with Alex Craner yesterday, and Alex, I think he's great. He's a friend. But I think he gives Donald Trump way too much benefit of the doubt that he really understands what he's doing. I don't think he does, because this kind of comment is just so gratuitous, so unnecessary. What does it accomplish? Is this comment meant to have a closer relationship with Russia, India, and China? Just the opposite. You know, his remarks remind me of a teenager. You know, pick your boy or girl, doesn't matter, who's broke up with their boyfriend or girlfriend. And now that boyfriend and girlfriend are going out with somebody else. And, all they can do is issue catty comments. I was the best thing in your life. And now you're going to go ahead and, curse on both of you. You know, that kind of thing. What does it accomplish? Nothing. But the entire, ideological foundation for neocon policy towards China over the last 20 years has been predicated on keeping Russia and China apart, and using Russia as a battering ram, as a wedge, something, we can destroy Russia, we can break it up, but we're ultimately, the target is China. And maybe that it's more accurate to say it's been 10 years, but Trump's fallen into that trap. He is, instead of saying, hey, let's figure out a way that we could all work together. I mean, be genuinely the peace president. But that's not what he's doing. He is you know, basically throwing these cheap juvenile insults at these countries. And I, you know, Putin's reaction to the previous truth, that's what, you know, Trump calls them truths. You know, the one where he said that they were all conspiring against the United States. But Putin just said, ah, that Trump, he's a joker. You know, he was just, it's his attempted humor. They just brushed it off.
Yeah, he said that they're conspiring. Yeah, go ahead, Colonel. Yeah.
I was just going to add, I agree with what Larry just said. Just add that he needed to include more people in that salutation. There were 10 countries there and observers too, like Afghanistan. They're all in a better place. They are all in a better place than we are right now. And we are becoming rapidly in a worse and worse place. So you should have extended your congratulations, if you will, to all of those countries, from Kyrgyzstan to Pakistan to Mongolia and Afghanistan, who are aspirants, Belarusia, the whole panoply of SCO people.
It seems, Colonel, that it's somehow it's much complicated that it seems, because you look at India, do you think that the India agenda is somehow the policy toward India on the part of the Trump administration somehow connected to the tariff policy, or it's all about the case of Ukraine? I don't feel that it's all about the case of Ukraine. It's, how do you feel about it?
My personal view is that, and I have almost given up trying to crawl into Trump's head. I mean, it's just too confused. If I could crawl into it, I'd want out immediately. Mm-hmm. I'm sure of that. I think it's all about Russia. And I think he sees India as having been disloyal, if you will, because they will not break away from Russian oil, and they will not break away, I'm told now, even the Navy back again. The Navy was gravitating as slowly as it had to, because Delhi didn't like it too much, towards the U.S. Navy, because they prefer, frankly, sailing with the U.S. Navy in the Indian Ocean. They love the U.S. Navy in the Indian Ocean. At least that's what all the sailors I know tell me, whether they're Airedales or surface warriors or whatever. It's a very close relationship in a very difficult and huge ocean complex. Now they're even gravitating back to where they were before. And so Russia's stolen a march on us, if you will, with regard to India. And I think that makes Trump very angry.
Larry, it seems that the Trump administration is divided in different factions, and these factions are not helping each other. The communication between these factions is not that much good. Do you feel that, after all, is Donald Trump himself is behind the one of the most important decisions going to Russia and China in the case of Ukraine?
That, you know, your question presupposes that there's that Trump is actually thinking strategically. Now, I've got some friends that, you know, and we disagree on this point. One of them thinks that actually Trump's, you know, got a plan, and he's following the plan, and he knows what he's doing. I don't think he does. It's very much emotional, you know. And you watch what he's, you know, the other day he was talking about, on the one hand, he's criticizing Russia, India, and China, but then he's talking about, oh, they're such great friends with me. Oh, they, you know, they can't help but like, you know, they can't help but like me. And you know, part of it as well is just the ignorant things that Trump says that show no understanding of history. You know, for example, with respect to India and Pakistan, Trump doesn't understand about the long relationship that the United States has with Pakistan, and particularly through the CIA and ISI, that stretches back, you know, 65 years or more, with the U-2 base being in Pakistan, and then Pakistan always playing a very prominent role in CIA covert operations, first in the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, and then again when we went back to war in Afghanistan after 2001. So there, you know, and without understanding that India all along had sought a relationship with the then Soviet Union, you know, they wanted to have friendly relations with the West, but they had a strategic relationship with the Soviet Union. Or Trump's crack the other day about all the blood and sacrifice the United States shed in World War II to defeat the Japanese. Again, in World War II, the facts are this, that the World War II started for China in 1938 when the Japanese started attacking, and the United States did not do a damn thing to speak up, protest what Japan was doing to the Chinese, number one. Number two, 70% of Japanese military forces during World War II were in China.
No.
They were not out in the Pacific. They were in China. So China was fighting 70%, well over two-thirds of the Japanese army. And as a consequence of that, while the U.S. Marines, soldiers, and sailors in the Pacific theater, 110,000 U.S. Military personnel died in the Pacific during January 1942 until August 1945. The Chinese lost 3.5 million. So, obviously the Chinese, their ability to pin down the bulk of the Japanese force in World War II is actually what enabled the United States to prevail. If anything, we should have been thanking the Chinese, not the other way around. But again, it goes back to Trump's ignorance, a lack of curiosity, and he got his knowledge about the Pacific War from watching John Wayne and Sands of Iwo Jima.
Now, I would just add that most Americans, I'm sad to say, are probably in the same boat that Larry's just attributed to Trump.
Yeah.
Now, I will admit that Kuomintang, and it was Chiang Kai-shek and his forces that probably did the most damage to the Japanese, because the Long March people, the people ultimately triumphant in China, would stay away from the battles if they could, because they wanted to conserve their power for the struggle in China, an understandable motivation for a guerrilla group. But still, as Larry said, China did a hell of a lot that caused our war in the Pacific to be a lot easier, just as the Russians did on the Western Front. And Americans need to wake up. It does you no good to really know a patriotic version of history that is a patent lie.
Yeah. And, on top of it, again, this gets back into history, but who was supplying China? Who was the major supplier of China to keep them in the game militarily? That was the Soviets, the Russians. So, our failure to understand history, excuse me, and appreciate these relationships with these countries go back, a long ways. And again, we fail to take that into account.
Colonel, we had Kaya Kallas coming out and saying that they feel Russia and China, they feel that they won the World War II. It's somehow amazing that she doesn't know even the history of what has happened, and trying to rewrite or trying to manipulate the history. Who's gonna buy that? Does she have a particular audience that she's targeting?
And who I missed who you were
talking about. Kaya Kallas is European. Kaya Kallas.
Oh, I got
the
it.
European, yeah.
I got it. I was trying to figure out if you were talking about Ursula or
no, Kaya Kallas.
We all have our myths, and we all have particularly our national myths. And much of America's history is a myth. And that's not so bad as it might sound if you think myths just equate to lying, because everyone has a national myth. Every country, I would vouchsafe, has a national myth of some sort or the other. That myth is what you consult when you have problems and when you have conscience problems in particular, and when you have security problems, you go back to that myth. It's a very powerful thing in history. But if you contaminate that myth to the point where others are so looking at you as they are now as a pariah whose whole purpose in life is to make their life miserable or even to kill them through sanctions or military action, like that happened on the high seas against every freaking part of international law that still exists recently off Venezuela, then your myth begins to be contaminated. And the more your myth is based on lies, and myth and lies are not the same thing, but the more that your national myth is based on lies and other people intuit or know that from their own research and study, they're not stupid in other countries. Invariably, they're smarter than we are these days. Then the worse you are off in terms of your position in the world vis-a-vis them and ultimately vis-a-vis yourself. Dan Grazier's got a piece out right now that I agree with 100%. 15 years ago, I would not have said that. He's at Stimson, I think. And his piece argues that China has no interest in using force against Taiwan. And we're the ones saying that that's the case.
Yeah,
that's absolutely right. And I wouldn't have said that 10 or 15 years ago when I was wargaming that scenario virtually every year with all the joint war colleges. The reason is simple. China is winning. And there's no way they want to jeopardize that victory with a war that might bring on what I think SCO was in part about, might bring on the dying empire's use of nuclear weapons, because nobody wins that. Not the Chinese, probably not the world. So they do not want a war. It's kind of like Putin, but it's a different set of circumstances. He's winning. He doesn't want a ceasefire. He wants to complete the job of destroying the Ukrainian military's ability to wage war ever. He wants that done. And he wants the Nazis gone and a few other things, too. China's in that same kind of boat. It's not waging a war unless you consider the economic situation a war. But it is winning. And why do you want to go to war over Taiwan when you're winning? Because inevitably, as Sun Tzu had said, Taiwan will be a material part of China.
Larry, what can we learn from Washington? In my opinion, there has to be some sort of huge discussions about what would be the future of the United States. How do they want the United States to be in the near future? Are they going to continue with this sort of political and military conflicts with Russia, China, Iran, and no Venezuela, and what's going on? Many people are arguing that the case of Venezuela is some sort of false flag and some sort of distraction from what's going on with Epstein files. But you're taking that.
I admire your optimism that you believe that somebody's thinking about the future and having a strategic thought. I don't see any presence of any strategic understanding. And it is very much a reactive system that is responding to what's oftentimes in the news side. Well, you've got two things. You do have this bureaucracy, this deep state, and it's not just confined to the government, because they're connected to the defense industry, they're connected to the media, but they all, they're sort of pursuing, they've got their own objectives. Now, Trump's not consulted on that, I'm sure. And it doesn't matter who's president. It's just sort of rolling forward. Again, I'm still not sure, though, it's a strategic vision, because if we're thinking from a standpoint of strategy, we would have a defense industry that was actually producing relevant weaponry, systems that were not terribly expensive and not almost impossible to replace. I think there is this hardcore that is they're going to break up Russia. That's goal number one, and then take out China after that. That's sort of it. Now, we've got sort of some interesting, I'll call it circumstantial evidence of that. Do you know how large the U.S. Embassy is in Armenia? Armenia is a pissant little country. I mean, 2.8 million people. No offense to Armenians, okay? But like Georgia. Georgia is less than 3 million. So Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. Armenia has the largest embassy per capita in the world. In other words, what I mean by that, the number of U.S. Diplomats that are at that embassy is 14.3 per 100,000 of a population in Armenia. What, 400? Are you kidding me? And yet, you got to say, well, what are they doing? Well, I guarantee you, and I don't, this is not based upon any classified information I've ever received, but just an analytically looking at it, I guarantee you there's a CIA presence there. And one other task and mission is to target Russia, and the other is to target Iran. That's why you've got that huge embassy with this many Americans. So it comes back that instead of Trump coming in and really setting the tone of what the foreign policy is going to be, it's being set for him in a lot of these crucial areas. And go back and ask yourself, when did the conventional wisdom in the United States suddenly turn and become so anti-Chinese? Because it wasn't that way 20 years ago, 25 years ago. But, you know, somewhere between George W. Bush and Barack Obama, all of a sudden it became, yeah, you know, we got to stop China. And China's trying to take Taiwan. And after Tiananmen Square back in, you know, what was that, 90, 91, you know, I remember the reaction in America at the time was, you know, sort of shocked. But that didn't even turn it into what it is now, with this routine commentary about, oh, you're going to go to war with China, and we're going to, you know, we've got to, China's an enemy. There's absolutely, the entire attitude has become one of confrontation towards China. So that doesn't show me any kind of strategic thinking.
Nima, I would just add that the embassy in Beirut fits the same description.
Yeah.
Very same description. Monstrosity. But it is to protect the real people working there.
I think the South for Russia is so important. Today, there is a forum that they call it Eastern Economic Forum. And Putin talked about what's going on with the case of with the main concerns of Russia. He was asked about the east and the west of the country. And he said, not only east and the west, but also to the south, Russia is so concerned about what's going on. And I believe that he's talking about Armenia and Azerbaijan, which were part of the SCO summit. And how do you see, Larry mentioned the embassy, the U.S. embassy in Armenia. How do you see these two countries? Do you think they're going to be that stupid to go in a direction which has led Ukraine to the way it is right now?
Probably based on how much money they get from who, at least initially. Then it'll be national interest if they have any sense. I'm reminded of Hugh Pope's book, Sons of the Conquerors. I don't know if you've read it or not, but Hugh is an Oxford-trained linguist, amongst other things, and a world traveler. And the book is about essentially the commonality of the Turkish-based language. He's also a linguist, from roughly Ankara all the way to Xinjiang province, and how throughout history for 2,000-3,000 years, you could do trade and commerce quite liberally and well throughout that area because everybody understood everybody fundamentally. They might speak different languages in the book, but they understood each other because they were all Turkic based. Well, in that book, in the centerpiece of that book are about 16 pages of photographs. And one of those photographs shows U.S. paratroopers, and it's labeled thusly, landing near the Caspian Sea. And underneath it says, U.S. military for the first time, as far as we know in history, lands in Central Asia. And I wrote in the margin, a historic moment, because this is the first effort to slow down the shift in power from the West to the East. And of course, it's in a very critical place because at that time, and I'm told by oil experts, it's still true, underneath the Caspian is enough oil and methane to fund Central Asia and much of China in terms of fuel needs for the next 100 years. Now, that doesn't say anything about climate change, but it's a very, very important part of the world. And the people who are going to control that are the people who know fundamentally that importance, but more key, have the means and the strategic acumen to do so. And as Larry just said, that ain't the empire.
Larry, here is one of the outcome of one of the main important points in the summit, in the SCO summit, which was this pipeline. Mm-hmm. And I've learned yesterday that Andrei Martyanov mentioned that there is a third pipeline going on between Russia and China. And what has happened on Fox News, we've seen that they reported this way. This is the way that Fox News is talking about the pipeline.
Customers in Europe. Now, America is selling energy to the French and Germans. So Putin's putting down a big old pipeline to China. It's supposed to be finished next decade and supply 15% of China's energy. Russia and China are growing closer. Someone might have to bomb that pipeline like Nord Stream. Trump's not thrilled with Pooty Poot.
Yeah.
I mean, William Hurst, what was his name?
William Randolph Hurst.
Yeah, Citizen Kane.
Yeah,
is back. He's back. He's in fox garb.
Yeah, Jesse Waters is a moron. Okay, to be polite, the world is leaving the United States behind. China is technologically leaving us behind. You know, you probably, if you had that clip of Trump the other day where he said, "Oh, we're the greatest, we're the hottest, we're the best," you know, there's no other countries, we're so wonderful. And it's like, dude, if the United States is so great, why is it that you had to rely on Russia for 20 years to take your ass to the space station? You know, we lost the ability to launch rockets that could carry astronauts to space, to the space station, and get them back in a timely manner. Now, you know, we celebrate, oh yeah, we brought them back because Elon Musk developed the capability. Oh, he's a South African, last I checked. So this constant self-delusion that America is the greatest, the best, and ignoring what's taking place in China. You know, they're building, they've built the world's highest bridge in a very short span of time. They've got high-speed trains that connect the country. Their cities, it's not just one magnificent city. They've got multiple magnificent cities that are just, are incredible in terms of both their beauty and their size. And, you know, instead of us waking up and going, you know what, the Chinese have made a transformation over the course of the last 50 years that I don't think there's nothing in history that compares with it. And our refusal to accept it and recognize it for what it is, the absolute genius. Instead, we continue to disparage it. And, yeah, you know, Mao Zedong killed a lot of people. You know, they've got some bad things. But, hey, we've got bad things in our history, too. We just like to clean it up and ignore it. But, you know, it wasn't the Chinese that came over here and said, "Nits make lice," when they were justifying killing the American tribes. That was us. So, you know, instead of dwelling on the past about, you know, who was the worst, let's look at where we are now, who's doing what. And the Chinese are moving very, they're not stopping in building a society that's, you know, got universal literacy now. The United States used to, we're now at 79% literacy. So I just, I watched this sort of pettiness and childishness on the part of Donald Trump, and just, you know, it's he's taken us in the wrong direction, I think.
Carl, how did you find the parade, the military parade, Chinese military parade, and what was the importance of it? Do they really want? Because when you're looking at the mainstream media in the West, it seems that they see China as a threat. But the message from the Chinese leader, the Chinese president, he said that they have to choose between war and peace. We want war or peace, between cooperation and confrontation. He's not going, he didn't say anything about new conflicts, going to war with the United States, with any other country. It's all about their defense capabilities. And here is what the U.S. ambassador to NATO said on Fox News.
Yeah.
These other countries are having to respond. And, you know, China, I will note, I mean, most of the military equipment they demonstrated in this parade was technology most likely stolen from the United States or our allies. And, you know, they can't, couldn't fight the United States if they tried. You know, we are the only world superpower with the biggest, strongest economy. And that's what we need to continue to do. We need to continue to invest in our defense. And we also need to make sure that we continue to protect the American dream and the American.
Yeah.
Why does the United States need to fight China?
Well, it's utterly absurd what he just said. And I'm ashamed that he's our ambassador over there. Really, I am ashamed. And let me just add to what Larry was saying, with which I agree, but it's also true from Dushanbe to Samarkand. It's looking like the best hotels in the world now, for example, are in those cities. I don't care whether they have authoritarian leaders or not. The progress that they're making is scintillating. And eventually, probably, the people will get a little bit bigger share of it. I don't know for sure, but I hope they do. But it is happening all across Central Asia. And the motive force for that is China. And you're absolutely right. They do not want a war. Why on earth would the number one economy in the world, let's get that straight, it's not the United States of America. I can run you down 100 different parameters that will prove that. Everything from a million charging stations in China to 1/60th of that in the United States. I could go, as Larry said, to the high-speed rail, which we have none of, which connects almost every place in China of merit, and people can ride on and have a decent ride and a decent meal and come out at the other end and come back to in what? 1/3 the time it takes us to go, even on a very broken down Amtrak Acela from Washington to New York to Boston. Believe me, I know, I ride it. They can't even go the full speed because the rail bed is so bad, it would be dangerous to do so. We need to wake up and smell the coffee in the kitchen and the roses outside the window. They are coming in from China, not from what we're doing. And I will say this really pointedly. When thou hast to protest so vigorously about American dominance, check your feet and your butt, because that dominance is not present.
Yeah. I just posted gave in the chat for you, Neva. I put a video in there from YouTube that compares the Chinese and the Russian parades, the May 9th parade in Russia, the September 3rd parade in China, with that July 4th debacle that Trump put on. What you see in both the Chinese and Russian militaries is attention to detail, where the chain of command made a point that from top to bottom, they were going to march with precision. They were going to dress appropriately. they were going to have everything polished. And we're not talking a group of 25 or 50 people. Literally 10, probably more than 10,000 in China the other day. And more than, you know, 5,000 in Russia on May 9th. And so when you watch what was passing for U.S. Close order drill, they were walking out of step. They were, the uniforms were, you know, they didn't have dress uniforms at all. They had on these, you know, their fatigues. And several were overweight, you know, just, and that's what we've become, a joke. And you say, well, what's the importance of being able to, you know, have everybody line up and march in unison? It wasn't just marching. This thing was choreographed, right? You know, sort of like putting on a Broadway show where the dancers have to do certain moves. And the kind of movements the soldiers were making in March, that's, you know, that goose, stiff leg, out, pause, just go out to your driveway or outside and try that. See what you can do for 5 minutes. Damn exhausting is what it is. So that is just one more display, if you will, that Russia and China actually care. The United States, we don't.
Let me add to that, Nima, that I got a note from a friend in Poland who said, we're getting Abrams tanks, or we have Abrams tanks. I can't remember which it was, but says, what do you know? And I said, well, are you going to get 5,000 gallon or at least 2,500 gallon fuel tankers? Because you need a 5,000 gallon fuel tanker to follow every two Abrams. That's how much fuel they drank. He was shocked. You're kidding me. I said, no, that's how much fuel they drink. We requisition every 2,500 gallon and 5,000 gallon fuel tanker that we could, the Japanese helped majorly, in order to make that move in the desert in the first Iraq war. Otherwise, we couldn't have gone there. Yeah. I said, then if you're going to fight, this is Poland, right? If you're going to fight in a desert against an Iraqi armored force and you outrange them by 1,000 meters, that is to say, when you get them in 3,000 meters, you can kill them, and they have to get you within 2,000 meters to kill you, and they aren't that good at it anyway, you're in trouble. If you've got that kind of scenario, where's the desert in Poland? So, you know, one man's picking a poke is another man's joy, I guess. But in terms of military equipment, most of our stuff is turning into pigs and pokes.
Yeah. Larry, here is the video that you talk about, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, look at the U.S. on the right. Just... Yeah, I mean, it's just, it reflects an attention to detail on the part of the military leadership in both Russia and China, and the lack of attention to detail by the officers in the U.S. Army, you know, the U.S. Army, Marine Corps, etc. You know, I was listening to Doug McGregor tell a story about when he was a cadet at West Point, and a guy later became, you know, he's known as George of the Jungle, General Jawan. And Larry knows who I'm talking about. He was a major back then, and he came in and discovered that they, you know, they had a towel that was not properly folded. Think about that. He made an issue, the fact that one of the cadets had not properly folded their towel. But his point to them was, gentlemen, details matter. If you don't pay to get in the habit of paying attention to details and preparation and doing things properly, then when you're put into an actual real world situation that may involve combat, you revert to that which you've been trained to do. If you've been trained to ignore details, you're going to ignore some important details and probably get yourself killed. And that's, you know, so this isn't, I'm not just taking cheap shots at, oh, we weren't good at choreography for the, no, it's symptomatic. It reflects something, a bigger problem with the United States.
Nima, I'll add that General Bruce Clark, whom I came to know quite well, who was the real hero of the U.S. defense at Sainte-Vite and defense against the German counteroffensive in the Ardennes in 44 and 45, two armored armies, one Panzergrenadier army. Clark, when he was a four-star general, was what we call the Continental Army Command commander. And he used to walk around military bases, and he would just look at a lieutenant who walked past a cigarette butt, walk over to the lieutenant and say, "Lieutenant, you see that cigarette butt down there? I don't see any privates around to pick it up. You probably should bend over and pick it up. If you don't, I will. But if I have to, you're going to get an ass chewing you like you've never had before." The smallest detail never escaped General Clark's attention. And that's what Larry's talking about. We don't do that anymore. Our generals don't even walk around looking for cigarette butts. I know that's just a metaphor for the fact that our generals are lost in their pursuit of a post-retirement job, six or seven figures, and lost in politics at the top all the rest of the time that they're in uniform. We don't have a general in the United States Army, Nima, that I would follow to a shithouse.
Larry, you didn't mention the case of Venezuela. What's your take on that? We've seen a new footage that shows that two F-16 fighter jets flying directly over the USS Jason. And what's going on in the Caribbean Sea, and what do they want from Venezuela?
Well, let's separate out what we're being told, but then also raise the question of, is it true? I've had, some suggest that what we're seeing was an AI generated image. Possibly. But here's what the story just doesn't make sense. Okay, so this is one of these fast boats. It's got three outboard motors on it, and they're going from Venezuela to America with drugs. How are you going to refuel those? Because those outboard motors are going to last. they can probably run for about an hour, maybe 2 hours. Then you're going to have more fuel. Well, I didn't see a tanker, oil tanker floating by to, pull up and give them, they could buy gas. And it's not like there are floating gas stations in the Caribbean or the Gulf of Mexico / Gulf of America. That's number one. Number two, the goal of drug trafficking is to move drugs, narcotics. You got 11 people on board the boat. There's no room for the drugs. to label Maduro as some big cartel guy, it's just nonsense. Look, I've my consulting firm, Berg Associates, we were at our height, we were three partners. My other two partners, one would have been the chief of international ops for DEA, and the other one ran undercover money laundering operations in New York City for DEA. And so we worked, our very first case was the Bank of New York Russian money laundering case. So we worked money laundering, drug trafficking cases. This is not how those cartels operate, by loading up a boat like that. That may have been the case in the 1980s with Miami Vice, but that's not the case today. But the broader issue, and the one that I find so disturbing, is this was an act of, if it happened, and if we really did kill those people, it's an act of murder. Yep. It's a crime. Look, if they're really drug trafficking and you spot the boat, the first thing you do is you try to stop it and board it. Now, if they start firing at you, if they start shooting at you, okay, then a rule of engagement would come into play, and you can fire back. It would be appropriate to fire back and kill them. But that's not what we had here. We saw zero evidence that that boat was posing any kind of threat to the life of any U.S. military personnel or law enforcement personnel. None whatsoever. And yet we killed them first. Sorry, the other thing I did over a course of 23 years was script counterterrorism exercises for JSOC. And I never saw, out of 253 exercises that I was involved with scripting and executing, I never saw a single rule of engagement where Delta Force or SEAL Team 6 or our 75th Rangers were given permission to shoot unarmed people, people that hadn't fired on them. You know, the ROE was always pretty strict. So this is like saying it's okay to go kill them just because we think they're bad. So the whole thing stinks. I think this is part of a broader the renewal of Trump's failed effort in his first term to replace Nicolas Maduro through a color revolution. And this is the next attempt at it to force him out and get control of Venezuelan oil.
Yeah.
Nima, let me just add that either Larry's right that this is a possible visual chimera, however you say that word. I've been schooled in how to say it recently, that was put together to scare other people who might challenge what we are saying about drug trafficking and so forth. Or, as Larry indicated, it's a complete and utter violation of international law, of domestic law, and of the rules of engagement that the military I served in always operated under. It's unconscionable to think they would have done something like that video depicts, because it is so illegal. And on top of all of that, it's unethical and immoral as hell. It is not in accordance with the way any military, let alone the Empire's military, the American military, should be operating. And I agree with Larry that the whole way they painted it, the surface and the engines and the size of the boat and the number of people on the boat, did not comport with drug trafficking. I work with the Cubans in the Mona Passage. I worked with the Coast Guard and the U.S. military that were down there liaisoning with the Cuban. And I don't know if it's changed miraculously, but they were really, in many cases, hard-pressed to catch the boats that actually carried drugs, because they were these huge, very fast, heavily fueled boats, cigarette boats, people called them in the jargon, that just raced at 90 knots across a relatively calm sea, and even 60 or 70 in a Sea State 3 or a Sea State 4 sea. So this is not, it just doesn't comport with the, and the other thing we encountered was these submarines they were building. They were small submarines, and there were only one or two people, and the rest was cocaine or whatever. And they were smuggling under the water, if you will, when they moved, showing their fear at that time of the, we had really closed down on both the Pacific side and the Caribbean side of what might be called the U.S.'s 10 to 11% of interdiction. Well, guess what happened when we did that, by the way? You know where they moved? And one of my Marines pointed this out to the Atlantic Command commander when there was an Atlantic Command. We had a seminar down there. If you do that, if you really close off and take 10 to 11%, which we have never achieved beyond, on both sides, Atlantic or Caribbean and Pacific, Gulf of Mexico and Pacific, then you're going to force it to go up the land in Mexico. That's what happened, and we contaminated the hell out of Mexico. That's what they did. So this whole drug war effort is a farce in many respects, and we are the ones who make it a farce. Yeah. This is not only farcical, but it's incomprehensible that we would have done this, unless, like Larry said, it's just a fake video in order to scare people who might think it's real. That's all I can figure it might be. And let's face something else, too. I don't know that much about Trinagua, but as I understand it from people who do, and Larry maybe can comment on this, their main money-making enterprise is people trafficking, mm-hmm. not drug trafficking. So were those people, if it did happen, if it actually happened, unconscionable though it is, if those people were killed and they were people being trafficked, holy mackerel, those are just innocent people who probably paid $2,500 to get on that boat and make a little short trip around to another place where they get picked up by some other unconscionable people, taken to the Darien Gap or whatever, and flooded into the flow of traffic south to north. We're killing those kind of people? Well, Bibi's doing it in Gaza every single day, five times as many people. So is this the way we're going to wage war in the future? This is not a good development.
Yeah. Larry, yesterday we were talking, I was talking with Richard Wolff and Michael Hodson, and Michael Hodson came out with a very interesting idea on the boat. He said maybe they had Epstein files on
the boat. We're fed a story, and we've become, you know, to quote the Pink Floyd song, we've become comfortably numb to the government killing people. Let's remember, if Trump did, you know, if this was really, they really did kill these folks on that boat, Trump's not the first one. Barack Obama did it to Anwar al-Awlaki, you know, an American citizen. They killed his son too. Now, and it was justified, well, we think that they're a threat, or we don't like what they're saying. You know, they didn't have a gun pointed at anybody, and they hadn't planted any bombs. But you know, again, so this is, we've grown to accept George W. Bush could do it, Barack Obama could do it, Donald Trump could do it, Joe Biden could do it, you know, it's okay. And Congress sits back and does nothing. You know, this is the illegal use of force, in my view.
We had a very revealing argument in, I think it was late 2001. Maybe it was early 2000, might have been January 2002. And almost everyone in the security complex was involved, including many intelligence personnel, and including leading at INR at State. And we had it over this very thing, and we had it over tenants' desire. Even at that moment, we still were not sure we wanted to do it, to arm Predator. And now we have, you know, Reapers, Predators, we have all manner of things out there that are silent killers and very lethal, very lethal. We predicted, some of us, that we would get to the point where these things were so usable. And in Obama's case, as Larry pointed out, so offshore, as it were, so far away, that they would grow into being the weapon of choice. And they would violate everything the Constitution stands for about the use of force and who authorizes it and who doesn't. And that they would lead to some killing that probably none of us in the ultimate future would like. And I think that's where we are now, to a certain extent. And when you get someone like Hegseth, who has no idea about what I'm talking about, but every idea about manhood and patriotism and Christianity and all the rest of the things he's advocating, you're doubly damned. And I think we're at that point.
Yeah. Larry Poon had a press conference in China on Tuesday night, if I'm not mistaken,
talking about
the latest news, the latest things about Ukraine. What did he say to the press? What was the importance of the main, what were the main points that he was trying to make?
He made a variety of points. He didn't really say anything new. He just reiterated what has been Russia's position all along. He did get an interesting question about, you know, talking to Zelensky. And so he went through a very, and this is not intended as an insult, but he went through a very lawyerly description and explanation of why it's useless to talk to Zelensky. And the first point he made, he says, look, the Constitution of Ukraine does state that, you know, you're not going to hold wars during or hold elections during war, and you can declare martial law. He says, but the Constitution doesn't say that a president who's elected to a five-year term, at the end of their term, they can continue to serve until they have elections. He says, their Constitution doesn't say that. What the Constitution said, I mean, it was really incredible. He's going through this explanation, said, what their Constitution does say is that at the end of that president's term, then the power reverts to the speaker, basically the Speaker of the House, or the head of the legislature, or the RADA. And he says, so, yeah, I'm happy to talk to Zelensky, but what's the point? Because he's not legally the president. His term has expired according to the Ukrainian Constitution. So, that was one of the points he made. He reacted as well to Frederick Merz, calling him the greatest war criminal of the modern era. And again, Putin doesn't take that stuff personally, and he doesn't feel compelled to go back and attack him. But he then went into an explanation. He says, look, we were one of three countries that signed an agreement back in January of 2014 to settle the Ukraine crisis when Yanukovych was in president. And he said, and what happened? The very next month in February, there was this bloody coup that was launched that killed lots of Ukrainians, and then unleashed the events that have put the special operation, led to the special military operation. So he says, these countries have to be aware that they bear the responsibility for this, not us. We are responding and reacting to what they're doing. And he made it very clear, look, we'd like to get this settled peacefully, but if not, we're going to end it militarily, period. And so it was, like I said, he wasn't creating any news from the standpoint of saying something that hadn't been said before, but he was just making it, helping clarify that, yeah, I really did mean what I said in the past.
Yeah. Using the phraseology, the greatest war criminal on the face of the earth, or whatever it was specifically.
Yeah.
Think about that for a minute. The man who fits that description is Bibi Netanyahu.
Exactly.
I mean, this doublespeak world would drive George Orwell nuts if he were still with us.
Colonel, I don't know if you've learned that Tony Aguilar was arrested. Here is the video of him.
Every American sitting at home right now needs to realize that you are paying for a genocide.
Rise up! Rise up, America! Rise up! It is time to take back this country from these corrupt politicians. It is time. It is beyond time.
We're going after the loaded dog.
Yeah. That's Josie, Nima. Josephine Gilbo, our Louisiana Creole at the Eisenhower Media Network, and was a serving officer in the United States Army. Very brave. Very brave girl, very brave woman. And it's, this is how we deal with people who are whistleblowers now. Mm-hmm. I dare say there isn't a whistleblower potential in the United States government. There must be thousands of them who doesn't shiver in their boots now about ever actually blowing the whistle. And this is part of their purpose, is to quieten down dissent by making it very, very obvious you're going to be majorly punished if you do.
What did he get arrested for? I hadn't heard that. That was news.
It was, there was a hearing in Congress that he went there that he was trying to make the, in fact, he was arrested because of calling out Congress for complicity in genocide in Gaza. He was in the hearing.
Oh, okay.
If it hadn't been in the Dirksen office building, if it hadn't been for Command Chief Master Sergeant Dennis Fritz and me and our presence to intervene between the Capitol Police and the Doctors Against Genocide when they first came into the building to meet with congressional members and talk with them about the genocide. These were doctors and nurses. The Capitol Police had their plastic handcuffs out and they were going to arrest them. And we intervened and we moved with them quickly into the offices of the congressman we were going to visit with, got them out of the limelight. And then we sent some pretty nasty emails to the general counsel and also the head of the Capitol Police. And we got some apologies back. But that's what we're doing now if there's no one there who knows the system a little bit to challenge it.
Israel wants to capture 83% or 88% of the West Bank, Larry. And a lot of, even UAE came out and talking that you're not going to do that. Because with the case of Abraham Accords, they're not going to have, the case of Abraham Accords is just removed from the scene if you do that. I would wonder if they're still talking behind the scene about the Abraham Accords that we're not aware of.
That I don't know. What is clear is that the Zionist crazies, the settlers, they are intent on, you know, confronting and taking the West Bank, and you know, Trump is playing along with it. You know, the fact that they prohibited, they banned all Palestinians, not just, you know, the Palestinian Authority from the United States, but they've, you know, banned all, you know, not going to, they've made them all persona non grata, essentially. At least that's my understanding. And the killing keeps going on and on. So, you know, when I hear like someone from the United Arab Emirate or Jordan, you know, the fact of the matter is there are things that countries, you know, there are things that India, Russia, and China, for example, could do that I think would accelerate the end of this Zionist campaign. And that's just impose a complete total embargo. No more trade with Israel. One way, no more imports or exports. Shut them down. But they don't, no, nobody's doing, the only country doing anything of substance to try to stop Israel are the Houthis in Yemen. The only ones. Everybody else is just, you know, they talk a good game, but do nothing.
What I've heard about the Abraham Accords, Nima, and Larry may have heard this too, is that the guy keeping them alive, so to speak, because the people know who's behind him, is Jared Kushner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know if you heard about the Lebanese government session.
Yes.
They were trying to just, with the case of disarming Hezbollah, and the session collapsed because Hezbollah's member, and together with other members that are close to Hezbollah, Amal, all four Amal and Hezbollah ministers walked out, and they collapsed the session. There is no, it's some sort, Larry, it's somehow amazing. Colonel, I'm talking to you. It's somehow amazing to me that there is no solution on the part of the United States. Everything you get there, even with the policy forcing these people, they're not going to get anything out of what's going on in Lebanon. But they're insisting on this failed sort of policy. What do they want to get from Lebanon? They know that if even not moving that far against Hezbollah, they know what would be the outcome of that.
Well, you know what my general interpretation of the whole thing is? It's contrary to what John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt have said, though I think there's lots of truth in what they've said superficially. And I don't mean it's not important. It is important that Israel buys our Congress. But the real reason things are happening is because the neoconservatives, the globalists, as Doug McGregor calls them, other oligarchs behind the scenes, they want what's happening in the Levant. They want chaos there. They want ultimate chaos, if necessary, to bring down the regime in Tehran, for example. It's sort of an unfinished job. Then maybe they even want to go further than that. Think of the British, for example. You could rule the whole area if you bought the kings and queens. Well, now you kill the kings and queens. That's what it's all about. They're doing our dirty work in the Levant, and our dirty work is just as unstrategic, as stupid, as ignorant, as dumbly executed and conceived as all the rest of the things we're doing. Only in that region, somewhat like Ukraine, but I think to a more hideous extent, we're killing a lot of people. But we don't care. Lindsey Graham is a perfect example of that. If they weren't doing it, we'd have to be there doing it. That's almost a direct quote of Lindsey on the floor of the Senate. We like other people to do our killing for us now, partly because we can't do it ourselves. Our military is broken, but also because it really conserves effort and money and blood, which sometimes can haunt you as a politician if you exhaust it too fast.
Larry, one of the countries that we didn't talk about in the summit was Iran. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at the Iranian media and what's going on within Iran, you understand how the public opinion, together with those main policymakers in Iran, are moving eastward. And it's amazing to me, even having the Pezeshkian administration, those people who are so willing to have a better relationship with the United States, they're just giving up on their mindset, on their policies, on the way that they were thinking of the United States. How do you see Iranian policy? Do you think that after all, these people would prevail, would convince the government, the totality of Iran to go eastward totally?
Well, I think Iran is, from just a natural survival standpoint, the developing the relationships with Russia and China are essential to getting the economy going, you know, keeping the economy alive. You know, it is a complete change from what it was 10 years ago. In 2015, China and Russia were both willing to sign on with the West to impose sanctions on Iran as part of the JCPOA. Now, you notice, I guess, in the last couple of two or three days ago, some member of the Iranian legislature attacked Russia verbally, accusing Russia of having supported Israel in the attacks. And man, the Russians were furious.
He was not legislator, Larry. He was part of the one of the councils in Iran. He's not legislator. Yeah, he's not. He was not. And he was close to those people who are seeking a better relationship with the West. And he felt that by this sort of argument that they're not going to they do something, some distraction from what's going on.
Yeah.
Go ahead. And
But the Russians pushed back hard, and Pezeshkin was, we'll take care of this guy. But you watch Pezeshkin, he was front and center at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. He was right in the middle, the second row. They didn't put him out on the periphery. So they're recognizing Iran. I think Iran has come to realize that it's past, that past desire of some Iranians to have a closer relationship with the West, that's now being replaced with the recognition the future is with the East. The future is with BRICS. The future lies with Russia, China, India. And, the West is going to continue to do everything in its power to try to disrupt and destroy Iran. I saw that Iran submitted a complaint to the United Nations about a recent terrorist attack that took place in Iran coming out of Balochistan. And I guarantee us this had CIA funding behind it. Iran is, I think being weaned away from its obsession with having a closer relationship with the West. I think it now realizes that's not a viable option.
I agree with Larry. But let me just say that to me, this is a colossal indication of how stupid we are. The Iranians, and you know this, Nima, the Iranians have tolerated the overthrow of Mossadegh. They have tolerated the before that, after that, rather, the 26, 25 years of the Shah, the Savak, and all the rest that that signified. They have tolerated all manner of Israeli perfidy after Israeli cooperation, for example, in the Iraq-Iran war on both sides, and the same with us. They've tolerated all of that up to the present time when, as Larry said, it's going away, that they like the United States. I mean, through all of that, they bred a population that favored the United States, favored the West. Look back, if you will, on the time when we actually said and did what we meant about being anti-colonialists and so forth. We've destroyed that. Yeah. We have destroyed that. We have pushed them just as assuredly as we pushed Russia into a relationship with China and ultimately India. We have pushed Iran in. I don't think there are too many Iranians anymore who would have a positive thought about the United States of America. And that is a true tragedy, because they were one of the few people in that region who did, and who did it despite all of the things we did against them to destroy it. But now it's been destroyed, I think. I think Larry's right. They're looking the other way. And traditionally, you know this, Nima, historically, they have always feared the Russians. And the Chinese were too far away and too inconsequential at that time for them to have any real feelings about them. Now they're in their arms. I mean, they were very prominent there, as Larry said, at the SCO summit. And I'm sure they're going to be at subsequent ones. And we've lost them. We've lost the potential. And all of this I attribute to the clean break strategy, not the globalists so much as the neoconservatives, and the neoconservatives who still want the overthrow of the regime in Tehran, or they will be substantially angry. It's got to happen. It's got to happen. And they're allied, as I've said before, with 50-plus million dispensationalists / fundamentalist Christians who believe that's necessary to complete the destruction of the Levant so Jesus can come down again.
Yep.
Larry, the case of Europe, before wrapping up, I want to talk about the case of Europe. It's somehow complicated because Europe is dealing with the conflict in Ukraine, and they have sacrificed a lot during the war. And we have immigration, all these problems coming to Europe. But you see Elon Musk is somehow trying to picture Europe as they're raping Europe and all of this sort of rhetoric. Here is the statistic coming out of London. One of the main issues that they're bringing up is the rapists going to London. Here is, it shows that, you know, the statistic is somehow amazing, that shows how, you know, 88% of British rapists are white. And considering 82% of British people are white, you know, out of 82%, 88% are, you know, they did the crimes. And you go to the Asian countries, it includes India, Palestine, Bangladesh, China, and other countries.
Right.
It's 7%. It's 2022. And after, you know, it's some sort of hate speech, some sort of, you know, brushing all the people with, you know, it's unbelievable what's going on in Europe.
Well, facts are funny things. You know, you get a narrative going, and then how dare you introduce facts and actual statistics? So again, I've been watching. I'm pleasantly surprised, or I shouldn't say pleasantly, but I hadn't seen those statistics. Yeah, I'd heard the narrative about these Pakistani gangs raping all these girls, and that was the dominant primary activity going on right now. Then, wait, 80, you know, is basically the English guys, the natives, you know, it's not any of the foreigners. Okay, so boy, there you go, ruin a perfectly good narrative with facts. and we've seen the same thing with respect to Iran. You know, we're told, oh, Iran's the number one sponsor of terrorism in the world. Absolutely not true. Hamas is this massive terrorist organization. You know, over 25 years, the Palestinians. It wasn't just Hamas. Palestinians were accused, were attributed to having killed or been responsible for the deaths of about 1,500 Israelis over a 25-year period. Hell, that's just one day for the Israeli occupation forces killing people in Gaza. So, yeah, like I said, these facts start weighing in. Europe is it is in an economic crisis, and it's in a political crisis. And the political crisis is there is no consensus. There's no majority party. All you got are these fragments, segments, and those. So you wind up with a minority government that has to go out and enlist other so-called allies, and you have to make concessions and you have to sell out your principles at that point. But the fact is that all of these European countries across the board do not have a strong majority, like was the case, 20 years ago. You could at least say the Labour Party was dominant in the UK. But now look what's happening with Labour. And just in a period of, a year, 2 years, they have fallen so far out of favor that Nigel Farage's party has risen to the top. And so in the midst of this, their economies are indebted beyond, England's 100% debt to GDP. France is like 110. The claims are that the government's going to collapse Sunday or Monday in France, throwing it into a political and economic turmoil. Germany, yeah, their debt to GDP is like now 70, 79%. But it was 50% 3 years ago. So what's happened is as their economy's collapsing inward, they're having to go out and borrow more money. Yeah. And they are in a recession as well. So none of them are doing great economically. And yet, what are they all doing? Let's give billions of dollars to Ukraine.
5% of GDP.
Yeah.
Defense.
Yeah. It's totally irrational. So, I think this only ends with, with a car crash, an implosion of some sort.
Nima, another side of this, I got really rudely introduced to yesterday when you may have seen, was it Seddon that Al Jazeera that did the really powerful 45 minute or so video on Mahmoud Abbas getting to Geneva, having the UNGA there, pretending his letter, getting a peace force and sending it to Gaza under Chapter 7 rules. In other words, ROE that says you can shoot. And this woman came in and she made a really good argument for how that wouldn't work because Mahmoud Abbas, and I admit this is true, is a crook and a filthy old man and so forth and so on. It has no interest to the Palestinians, only his own interests at heart. And any peacekeepers put in, the French, the Germans, the British, the Americans or whatever, would be so freaking colonial that it would just be an aid to Netanyahu that was better than his own strategy, but it would do the same thing in the end. And the only thing I could come back and say to her was, you've got a point, but if they were Chinese troops, maybe Indian troops, maybe Turkish troops like we had in Somalia, who were Sevik Bir was our commander in Somalia. He's a pretty good guy, pretty good troops. Might be different because they wouldn't put up with that sort of thing. They would end the killing and make sure the Gazans were fed and watered and so forth. But that just shows you the angst and the ire that exists towards Europe, because that was who she was really talking about. That would be the real peacekeepers, the French, the Germans, and the British and so forth. And that would be terrible, she said. And I admit it probably would be. It probably would be, because all we would do is put a patina of kindness on what, and humanitarianism on what would ultimately be the same thing, the extinguishing of the Palestinian state. She's right. But I do think I was right, too. If you put other peacekeepers in there from this new world of mourning, you might have a totally different situation. And I will bet you on a dime the IDF would not launch one round at a Chinese battalion.
Thank you so much, Colonel and Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Good way to end the week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bright and sunny.
Yeah, yeah. Great shirt. All right, gentlemen.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.